I think the most important thing that's going to come out of this is actually the pictures. In fact, I'm actually calling it the selfie summit.
The North Korean leader has taken his train to Russia for a selfie. This is Thursday, April 25th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, a new report claims North Korea is using cryptocurrency markets to evade global sanctions, likely being used to fund its weapons of mass destruction programs. A shakeup in Sri Lanka, as its president says officials failed to act on intelligence reports warning of possible attacks before the Easter bombings that killed over 350 people. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has arrived in the far eastern region of Russia for his first ever meeting with Vladimir Putin, which Kim says is the initial step toward closer ties with Moscow. Wearing a black fedora hat and matching dark overcoat, the smiling Kim was greeted by Russian officials and a military band Wednesday in the port city of Vladivostok. The North Korean leader made the short trip there via his signature armored green and yellow train. During an earlier stop in the border city of Kasan, Kim said this will not be the last trip to Russia, adding it is the first step toward improved Russia-North Korea relations that, according to a readout issued by the local Russian authorities. At the Thursday summit, Kim was expected to push Putin for economic aid, specifically relief from international sanctions that remain in place after nuclear talks with the United States broke down. Joining us is Harry Kazianis. He's director of Korean Studies at the Center for the National Interest and an expert in the region. Harry, there are all kinds of reasons being mentioned in the press for what is the most important thing that's going to take place at this meeting, ranging from what we just said, some kind of economic relief, if that is possible, to just the theatrics of it all.
Well, I think the most important thing that's going to come out of this is actually the pictures. In fact, I'm actually calling it the selfie summit because there's not going to be a lot of substance out of this. There's going to be a lot of pictures. There's going to be a lot of buzz on social media. But as to actually changing the status quo in Northeast Asia, as for giving Kim Jong-un any sort of economic relief or sanctions relief, I have to be honest, that is not going to happen. Those types of things would have to be granted by the UN Security Council, and that takes a unanimous vote. So just Russia and Kim meeting, while it is an important marker historically, is not going to change things for Kim, unfortunately.
So what is in it for both leaders?
Well, I think both of them want to show that they have options. Specifically, Kim Jong-un wants to show to Donald Trump that he has other people out in the world that he could go to, maybe in the future for potential aid if sanctions were to be removed. And I think for Vladimir Putin, the same thing is obvious. He obviously does not have a good relationship with the United States. So what he is trying to do is to do the same thing, to show that he has options. Essentially, both countries want to have a Russia card and the other wants to have a North Korea card. The question here is, though, is what can each of these countries do for each other? At the moment, not much. I mean, Russia has its own economic problems. They're not able to invest billions of dollars, say, into North Korea. They don't have the money and they'd be breaking sanctions. And as for North Korea, they only offer really Russia headaches more than anything else. So this is about pomp and circumstance and pictures and not substance.
What has happened to what apparently had been a relatively close relationship between North Korea and Moscow? What happened to it, and why does Kim and Putin want to bring it closer?
Well, simply that the Soviet Union's death in 1991 pretty much ended the old relationship they had. We have to keep in mind the whole reason North Korea has nuclear weapons and long-range missiles is because in one shape or format, they came from the Soviet Union. It was Soviet scientists when the Soviet Union actually collapsed in the early 1990s that went to North Korea and taught the North Koreans how to build nuclear weapons. In the 1950s and 60s, it was Soviet Union's nuclear technology that went into North Korea to build nuclear reactors and those things. So essentially, Moscow gave birth to this problem. But really, in the years since the end of the Cold War, the relationship has been very dormant. The Soviet Union obviously couldn't give aid when they were collapsing. And that is actually one of the reasons North Korea went into a large famine in the 1990s. And up to 1 million people actually died because they were not getting that food aid. So they are trying to reboot the relationship, but it's a far way off from where it was during the Cold War days.
Does this meeting change the balance of power as far as negotiations and just relationships between Russia, between North or South Korea, the United States, and China?
The only thing that could happen here, and you're starting to see inklings of this, is that the Russians may call for what are called the six-party talks to be resumed. This is something that happened in the early to mid-2000s when countries like Russia, Japan, China, the United States, and others all got together to try and solve the North Korean nuclear problem. They failed, and they failed miserably. The North Koreans actually used these talks and dragged them on for years. And while this was happening, they built up their nuclear program. So you could see Russia and China and some other countries try to use this as essentially as a bargaining tool with the United States. And I just hope we don't fall for it this time.
What about the visits of Kim to have meetings with the leaders of these various major powers? Has this elevated his stature either domestically or internationally?
Both. And I want to know who his PR rep is, because they're doing a fantastic job. Not only are they humanizing Kim, but you can see him slowly adopting more Western clothes. He looks more as if somebody that could even be approachable. And considering this is a man that has potentially 250,000 people in Stalinist sort of prison camps, that's a big feat to pull off. So the more of these visits he does, the more countries he goes to in his so-called armored car, he's being humanized. He's looked as a so-called legitimate world leader. And that's pretty troubling, to say the least.
Harry Kasianis is Director of Korean Studies at the Center for the National Interest. Harry, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. A former U.S. State Department employee accused of hiding extensive contacts with China has pleaded guilty to a felony charge of conspiracy to defraud the U.S. government. Rejecting warnings from the United States, Britain will reportedly allow China's Huawei technologies to play a limited role in the development of its 5G network. China is welcoming representatives from 150 nations, including senior leaders of 40 countries, to discuss its international infrastructure program at the Second Belt and Road Forum in Beijing. Japan passed a law compensating tens of thousands of people sterilized, often without their consent, under a government program to prevent the birth of inferior descendants. This is VOA Asia. North Korea is using cryptocurrency markets to evade global sanctions, and the virtual money is likely being used to fund its weapons of mass destruction programs. That is all according to a new report from the London-based Royal United Services Institute. Henry Ridgewell has more.
North Korea is subject to wide-ranging international sanctions following recent nuclear tests and long-range missile launches. Pyongyang is seeking ways to raise money and bypass those sanctions, and researchers say emerging cryptocurrencies could become a key lifeline for the regime.
North Korea is actually getting a significant amount of money through cryptocurrency, and they're getting it outside of the traditional financial system, which is the one that most people think about when they're thinking about how a weapons of mass destruction program might be financed.
Many cryptocurrency exchanges ban North Korean users. Pyongyang is accused of numerous hacking operations to get around these measures. In one 2017 attack on South Korea's Bitthumb exchange, it is claimed North Korean hackers stole Bitcoin and Ethereum virtual currencies worth $7 million. While cryptocurrency currently plays a minor role in Pyongyang's financial activities, Eisenman says the reclusive state has the capacity to exploit weaknesses in global regulation.
It's a national security threat, and it will just increase in the time to come. Cryptocurrency, especially if you're using coins such as Monero or Zcash that are privacy coins that aren't as transparent as Bitcoin, can be used and traded, and they don't need to go through the fiat system. They don't need to touch the dollar. They don't need to touch a bank.
The report's authors warn that Southeast Asia's burgeoning cryptocurrency industry is particularly vulnerable, as regulators are struggling to keep up with the technology. Meanwhile, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un arrived Wednesday in Vladivostok to meet with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, where the ongoing sanctions against Pyongyang are likely to top the agenda. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Happening now in Asia, the White House says two senior economic officials will travel to China next week to continue negotiations aimed at resolving the two economic giants' ongoing trade war. The statement says Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer will meet with Vice Premier Liu He in Beijing on April 30th. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us. Sri Lanka's president shook up that country's top security establishment after officials failed to act on intelligence reports warning of possible attacks before the Easter bombings that killed over 350 people. Government leaders have acknowledged that some intelligence units were aware of possible attacks weeks before the bombings that struck three churches and three luxury hotels. The death toll rose Wednesday to 359, with 500 people wounded. A police spokesman also said 18 suspects were arrested overnight, raising that total detained to 58. I spoke via Skype with Michael Kugelman, the deputy director of the Asia program and senior associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center for Scholars here in Washington. He said governmental dysfunction most likely led to the reason why that information was not communicated.
There's been a long-standing political crisis and a dispute between the president and the prime minister. And at one point last year, the president essentially tried to remove the prime minister from power. The Supreme Court reinstated him, but they continue to spar. And one of the consequences of this long-standing dispute is that the prime minister has really been cut off. His access has really been cut off to a lot of high-level discussions and business and activities. And I think in the case of these intelligence reports, you had the prime minister and those close to him who basically were not privy to all of these intelligence reports. Now, that raises the question, well, okay, the prime minister didn't know about them, but the president apparently did. Even though he claims he did not, there's good reason to think that he did. So I think that the president has tried to prevent the prime minister from being involved in a lot of key high-level activities and has been cut off from a lot of information. And so that includes these intelligence reports. The prime minister has claimed that if he had known about all of these reports warning of these attacks, he would have acted immediately. Now, we don't know if that's the case for sure, but I think it really comes down to divisions within the government, dysfunction, and that really poses as a distraction. So clearly that's going to deepen the anger and the unhappiness of the prime minister, and will make this relationship between the two top leaders of Sri Lanka even more difficult. Unfortunately, though, you know, this is the time where these two leaders need to set aside the toxicity in their relationship and find a way to move forward, because obviously Sri Lanka is in an extremely delicate state right now. It suffered this incredibly unprecedented catastrophic attack, and there's very real concerns that there could be reprisal attacks on Muslims, and that all of these longstanding ethnic divides and religious divides in Sri Lanka, which have really been under the surface, suppressed in the years since the civil war ended, that those could explode once again. And you need a united government to try to come out there and unite a country that is not only grieving, but also understandably very angry that their government essentially let them down in a huge way with tragic consequences.
Now, what happens to Sri Lanka's population? They really need some kind of answer, and so I guess does the rest of the world, about who carried this out, with reports now that these were pretty well-educated, middle-class people who carried this out, with ISIS claiming that it participated in this. Where does this all stand?
With credit to the government, I mean, it's acted in a big way to try to launch a full-fledged investigation to figure out exactly what happened. Now, the risk here, the problem is that the government could go too far in trying to demonstrate its desire to get to the bottom of this attack. The government declared a state of emergency, I believe, yesterday, or maybe it was actually on Easter, right after the attacks. And that gives the government and the military the right to essentially go into homes and do essentially what it would want to. So now you have to worry about, well-intentioned counterterrorism measures sort of merging into this very dangerous area of extrajudicial efforts that could imperil rights. And clearly that could stoke the tensions and the unhappiness, particularly among the Muslim community, if they begin getting targeted and singled out for no reason. I mean, let's keep things in perspective. The Muslim population in Sri Lanka is a minority. It's about 10% of the country, and the great, great majority of them are peace-loving. So to answer your question, the government is definitely moving forward, and many countries around the world, including the United States, have pledged to help. I mean, the FBI, as I understand it, is already on the ground helping out. There were, of course, several Americans that died in this attack. So I think that the international community will mobilize behind and in support of the Sri Lankan government. The question, though, is whether in its haste to try to get to the bottom of this horrific attack, if the government will go too far and risk provoking the very type of instability that it should be trying to avert.
Do you feel that there was the help of international terrorists in this attack?
Oh, no doubt about it. You know, the group that was identified as the perpetrator is a very small Islamist radical group that has been around for a few years, is extremist in its ideology and its thinking, but is very small and really has not done much other than, as I understand it, deface, spray paint a few Buddhist statues a few years ago after there had been some Buddhist mobs had attacked Muslims in Sri Lanka. So this is a group that goes by the acronym NTJ. It does not have any type of capacity to stage an attack like what we saw. I mean, if what had happened on Sunday had simply been, you know, a guy throwing a grenade at a single church, then sure. I mean, you could argue that that would not need any type of support from the outside. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, several attacks staged in a coordinated fashion. There's no way that the small group could have done it. And the only outside group that would have the capacity and the desire, I would argue, at this point in time to help would be ISIS. It staged attacks very much like the one that we saw. It's gone after religious minorities. The attack really had all the hallmarks of ISIS. So I think that it definitely was involved. The only question, and this is one that, you know, people like me who really think about these issues of terrorism a lot, were trying to figure out, why did it take so long for ISIS to claim responsibility? This is a group that loves to take responsibility within hours after the attacks happen that it carries out. In this case, it took 2 days, and I still don't know why, and other, you know, terrorism researchers don't know either.
Michael Kugelman and I spoke at greater length about the possible involvement of ISIS in the Sri Lanka attacks, as they have claimed. You can hear that part of our conversation on tomorrow's VOA Asia program. The capital of Colombo, meanwhile, remained rattled by reports that police were continuing to conduct controlled detonations of suspicious items 3 days after the attacks on churches and hotels. And the U.S. ambassador said that Washington believes the terrorist plotting is ongoing. Coming up, the U.S. lashes out at Myanmar's High Court. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Your requests, your dedications, and interviews and performances by your favorite music superstars. It's Border Crossings. This is Larry London. Be sure to tune in every Monday through Friday at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA or online at voanews.com. You've got control. Border Crossings, weekdays at 15 hours Universal Time at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. A UN report says more civilians are being killed by Afghan government and American forces than by the Taliban and other insurgents. The report says this is the first time that's occurred since the United Nations began documenting civil casualties in Afghanistan a decade ago. This is VOA Asia. We continue. The U.S. Wednesday condemned the Myanmar Supreme Court decision upholding the convictions of two Reuters journalists for violating that country's Official Secrets Act by uncovering the Myanmar military's massacre of Rohingya Muslims. The U.S. State Department said Tuesday's ruling against Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Juan Lon and Kwa Soo, despite serious irregularities in the case against them, sends a profoundly negative signal about freedom of expression and the protection of journalists in Burma, the Southeast Asia country's colonial name. This news alert from VOA Asia. An official says a fire in a sprawling Rohingya refugee camp in southern Bangladesh has destroyed more than two dozen huts and a mosque. The official in Cox's Bazar district says no injuries incurred in the fire, which broke out Wednesday in a camp in Cotopalong. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Just imagine stepping into a movie or virtual world and being able to interact what's there. That is now possible through the magic of Hollywood combined with virtual reality technology. For $20, the company Dreamscape takes visitors through a multi-sensory journey. Currently in Los Angeles, creators say they plan on opening more virtual reality venues across the U.S. and eventually to other countries. VOA's Elizabeth Lee tells us what to expect.
Once visitors step through these doors, they leave behind reality and embark on a journey to another world.
We see Dreamscape as a travel agency that will take you on adventures that transcend time, space, and dimension.
Bruce Vaughn used to work on Disney theme park attractions and special effects. Now he is the chief executive officer of Dreamscape Immersive. Imagine a trip to a zoo filled with alien creatures from outer space. Or going on a treasure hunt.
Below us, there's a pod of whales that needs our help.
Or an underwater adventure. That's the world Zach Green stepped into when he entered a Dreamscape room.
I kind of forgot I was in Earth for a second, and I was under the ocean.
Dreamscape makes it possible by combining Hollywood storytelling with the expertise of building theme parks. These ingredients are brought to life through virtual reality, says motion picture screenwriter and producer Walter Parks, who is also co-founder and chairman of the board of Dreamscape.
Our technology allows us at Dreamscape to actually track your full body, all of your movements, and render you in an avatar. We use the word registration, where we're actually registering you as a human presence inside a virtual world, is very unique.
Visitor Robin McMillan is wowed by the experience.
I think it's probably the future of entertainment in terms of a completely immersive experience. You kind of forget you're in a room.
Before stepping into the virtual world, visitors would first have to put on four sensors, one on each hand and one on each foot, have a backpack on, and virtual reality goggles. Now they're ready to step inside. Again, Bruce Vaughn.
We blur that line between the physical and the virtual by letting you actually reach out and pet an alien creature or, you know, have a torch that actually lights your way and it's physically there.
That's not all. Each person's backpack computer and the sensors in the room trigger special effects such as wind, mist, and ground vibrations. Six people at a time can take part in the 10-minute experience. The company is already planning new worlds for travelers to visit. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
This is Science in a Minute.
The Journal of the American Medical Association released two new studies that examine the sedentary lifestyle in the U.S. One study led by the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis suggests that between 2007 and 2016, time spent sitting among American teenagers rose from 7 hours to a little over 8 hours a day and 5.5 hours to nearly 6.5 hours per day for adults. The other paper from Johns Hopkins Medicine, which studied physical activity of women with cardiovascular disease, found that more than half weren't as physically active as they should have been. They added that the number of the inactive women had increased over the past decade. Sedentary lifestyles have been linked to higher risks of diseases and conditions such as cancer, diabetes, and heart disease. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast. Take VOA Asia with you. You can find us at voanews.com. And let's hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook and our email at voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Sina Abdul-Rahman, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. My name's Ira Melman. I am in Washington, D.C. Please enjoy your day.